But yeah, you should be good to go.
Okay. Thanks,
yes,
Alexis.
Okay, no problem. Oh, sorry. And then when you're done, just click drop.
Okay. Okay, now I know what to do when we're done. All right.
Great.
Here we
okay.
go then.
Well, how sounds good. And how much time do you have? Are you in a time crunch right now?
Not really.
Okay. Great. Well, again, my apologies. It's really alarming. I was by the phone early with my headphones all ready to
uh-huh.
go, and I just all really anyhow. Scary. So thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's
out.
A long distance, and who knows.
So strange. Well, maybe you could start by just talking a little bit about what brought your parents to Fairbanks in the first place.
Yeah, it begins right after World War II when my dad was in the Army and he served in the Aleutians. And, you know, it was windy and gray the whole time and there was nothing to do. And he had heard, you know, how beautiful Alaska was, but he didn't see any of that. And so when he had finished the coursework for his PhD, he applied for a job at, you know, what was then just U of A and is now UAF. And he was in the English department, and my mother was running the co-op nursery school, which was in the Eielson building. And the museum was there at that point. And, you know, during milk and cookie breaks, the little boys would all rush down and visit the bear. And anyway, we were there for 3 years. I was in 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. And then we went back to Detroit, which was where we were from. And thereby hangs a tale, but that's not really what I'm here to talk about. So,
no, but thank you for the background information. Can you talk? I'm trying. It's not in my nature. I normally kind of tend to jut in conversationally, so I'm trying to stay quiet so we have the clean audio. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your memories of Enid and also sitting for the portraits.
Yeah. And I could never call her Enid. You know, we wrote letters for years afterward, and she would always sign them Enid, and I would always say, "Dear Mrs. Cutler," you know, is just how I was raised. But I first met her in the summer of 63, when Lee Salisbury was doing a production of The Emperor's New Clothes, and I was one of two gong girls that preceded the emperor every time he came on stage. And the emperor was played by Tom Mutch. I don't know if people remember anything about him at this point, but he was a very large guy, and it was very impressive, you know, when he came out as the emperor in the new clothes. You know, there was something in the script about the underwear being torn, so he was wearing underwear. But, you know, he was just this very large guy with practically nothing on. Anyway, Mrs. Cutler was backstage after the production, and Emily May was the other gong girl, and she went to University Park. I went to Denali. Anyway, Mrs. Cutler was backstage afterward doing little watercolors of everybody in the cast. And so that was where I met her, just sitting for this quick portrait. And she was having such a good time. And my mother had actually helped her put up the sets before the production. There were several other faculty wives who had said they were going to be there, but only my mother showed up, and they worked far into the night getting it all done and became friends. So then it wasn't until the winter of 64, it was over, well, it was Christmas break then, I suppose they say winter break now, but we had a week off from school, and my parents had negotiated with Mrs. Cutler to do this large oil of me, and so I went over for a couple of days. Maybe it was even 3 days, I don't remember, and sat in her living room, and she had this big canvas set up, and I was actually sitting against a wall, but she kind of transposed it so that there was this scene of the southern sky with the sun just over the horizon, and there was ice fog. It was really cold that month, and I was sitting there with a guitar trying to look very serious, like a proper folk singer. But we were getting to be friends the whole time, and I think she fed me lunch even, and you know, we just started to talk. And then I don't know whether she thought I looked too serious, but after the oil had dried for about 6 weeks, she was going to bring the big canvas over to my parents' house, which was just kind of over the rise. We lived on North Chandelier. I don't think it had a name then. You know, it was just the road with the campus housing on it, and she was on Kobuk, which might not have had a name either. You know, but it was just through the woods there. And she called me that afternoon, and my mother was a little annoyed because she wanted to help out. She wanted me to help out with the preparations for the unveiling party. But I was going off to Mrs. Cutler's instead. But I got to her house, and Mrs. Cutler sat me down at the kitchen table, and she spread out this big sheet of paper and got out her oil crayons and watercolors and painted this other quick sketch of me, which is much more cheerful. And if you look at it from the right angle, there's kind of a smirk in it. And, you know, we were just talking about all kinds of stuff that I was interested in at that point. And she actually titled it Discussion when it was all over. And she signed it, and she had me sign it, and she dated it. And by that time, we were just very solid friends. I mean, I was 12, and she was, I think, 42. But we just got along. And after that, you know, I often popped over to her house. And in the summer, she took me blueberry picking once. And I was kind of friends with her daughter, Kristen, too. Kristen was 3 years older than me, and I used to see her on the school bus. And Kristen and I and some other kids put on a play in the summer of 65. You know, we were all into theater, and Kristen made a career out of that, theater with kids. So that's the short version. But there's a lot more. So what else do you want to know?
Oh, it's just neat to hear about your time here on campus and to hear more about Enid Cutler, because she, you know, has had such a presence. I never got to meet her. Was she as kind of social and gregarious as my sense of her?
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, that was one of the things that said in her obituary, that she was intensely social. But it was more than that. She had such a presence and a way of being present to you and being delighted to see you, and there was nothing artificial about that. You know, that there was just this light and warmth that came out of her. And she was the first person I'd ever met who was like that. And ever afterward, you know, when I was looking for people to fall in love with, that was what I looked for in them. You know, it was just so striking what she was like.
I feel like that comes across in her paintings.
I think it does, you know, the way she does people's eyes. And what she, you know, the way their presence comes through. You know, the way you know who you're looking at somehow in some profound way.
She seems to really be able to see who people are at their core.
Yes. So.
And then can you tell me a little more about the history of the paintings, if they then left Alaska?
Yeah, we had them carefully shipped, and we went back to the house that I had mostly grown up in, and then when I was a senior in high school, my parents found a nice place on this canal right off the Detroit River, and the big oil is in the dining room there. And the little portrait is at the top of the stairs in the upstairs hallway. And, you know, I kind of check in with them every time I go back, particularly the little one with the smirk in it. You know, I kind of have an understanding with it. about however I'm feeling about seeing my parents and however I'm feeling about Alaska and, you know, having just been there or, you know, really wanting to go back, which I always do. You know, it's got a personality.
And the two paintings make a wonderful pair. It's nice to hear that story again.
Mm-hmm.
About the kind of follow-up of background.
Yeah, no, it was very nice. And, you know, I should talk a little bit. Well, actually, I don't want to forget to tell you this story. I was just in Detroit visiting my mother. She'd been in the hospital, and, you know, there was a lot of logistical stuff to take care of before she could come home. And but we got talking about, you know, I said that you were going to be interviewing me about Mrs. Cutler, and she was talking about that was when Dr. Wood was president, and Mrs. Cutler and Mrs. Wood did not see eye to eye about a lot of things, and Mrs. Wood was very correct. I guess she was Southern, and she had very refined ways, and between courses, if she was, you know, giving a dinner, she would ring a little bell, and the help would come out and do whatever it was they were supposed to do. Mrs. Cutler was not at all like that. You know, she was very much a free spirit. And, you know, so I'm sure they tried to cope with each other, but there was one time I remember, which must have been the summer of 65 when I was seeing a lot of her, and we ducked under the hedge and snuck into the woods back garden and picked weeds and brought them back and put them in salad. And, you know, but whatever Mrs. Cutler did, I thought was perfect anyway. I wasn't really, you know, socially apt enough myself to realize what a transgressive thing that was. But, you know, when I look back on it, it's just wonderful.
That's a fantastic story. That really makes me wish I could have met her.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing, well, I want to talk about her kids a little bit. I never knew Thor particularly well. He was, I think, about 10 when I was 12, and we didn't really have anything in common. He just kind of came and went once in a while. I knew Kristen reasonably well and looked up to her, and she had this wonderful long hair that she wore up in a braid coiled around her head. But I saw her hair down once when she had just washed it, and she was out in the backyard combing it, and it, you know, reached almost to her knees. It was just great. And then Cheryl, the eldest, was already a dancer at that point, and I remember being in the Patty gym sometime when she was with a group, you know, working on some choreography, and I think Kristen also danced. Yeah, I remember her doing exercises in the living room, and that affected me seriously because when we came back to Detroit, I almost flunked out of gym class because I always hated gym class. But it turned out that the teacher, Catherine Ellis, you know, she I think she had studied with Martha Graham. She had done a lot of things before she became a high school dance teacher, and she was having auditions for her dance classes, and I thought, well, you know, if Cheryl and Kristen Cutler could do this, I can do it too, and it would get me out of taking regular gym for the rest of my high school stay. And so I went and auditioned and got in and did choreography, you know, through the rest of high school, and that was a very important thing for me. You know, that and the choir kept me sane, or as sane as one can be in high school. Interesting, both the teachers were Black, and, you know, that was a very big thing in Detroit, to, you know, the whole racial thing, especially during that period of the late 60s. And you know, I owe those two teachers a great deal. And about Cheryl Cutler, just recently, within the past few months, somebody that I know socially, and, you know, have kind of, you know, I respect her for certain things, and in other ways I think she's a little bit woo-woo. But we were talking once, you know, during a social event, and I said something about having lived in Fairbanks, and she said, oh, my dance teacher, Wesleyan, I think it was, was from Fairbanks, Cheryl Cutler. And, you know, I was holding on to something and I dropped it and said, you know, her mother was enormously important to me. And she said, well, you know, Cheryl was enormously important to me. And we, you know, we traded Cutler stories. And it seems as if Cheryl, you know, somehow picked up that way of her mother's, of being totally present to people and just making something of their life in some way that they hadn't known was possible. And I wouldn't be surprised if Kristen had done that, too. Both the daughters wrote books. I don't know if you know that.
No, I don't. I didn't, and I have no idea kind of what they're up to currently.
Yeah, Cheryl retired from teaching dance a while back and teamed up with somebody who had also taught at Wesleyan, and they do motivational workshops, and they wrote a book together called Creative Listening, which is quite interesting. You know, it's a motivational book, but she has a lot of anecdotes in it about her parents and their influence on her, which, you know, would be of great interest, I think, to people at the university. You know, just how Howard Cutler's mind worked about administration and a lot of things, and how Enid Cutler's mind worked about being with people. And then Kristen's book... Her married name is Kristen Bissinger, and her book is called Leap Into Learning. And her major in college was creative dramatics for children. And the book is a way of teaching elementary school and middle school curriculum through movement. And it's just amazing. You know, like showing kids how to enact volcanoes or DNA. Or, you know, a poem.
That's wonderful. I've just looked up both books on the computer while you've...
Uh-huh.
But they both look fascinating.
Yeah.
And really inspiring.
Yeah. And Thor, I know, worked for the EPA or something. It was all involved with the oil spill. Yeah, I don't remember, but I found something online about that, so, you know, it's possible to look up.
I had no idea. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well,
so
you know, Google is a great thing, because I didn't know any of this stuff until after Mrs. Cutler died, and then I was looking up things about her family. I was looking up things about the Dean family, whom I knew pretty well, and the Slotnick family, and... you know, you can find things, and it's really kind of lovely. And
yeah, it's a small world. My mother is having a coffee with Sue Dean.
Oh.
They're good friends.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't seen Sue in years. I mean, I knew her as the mom of my friends, the Dean boys. And when I was there in October for that visit... I saw her several times, and we've really gotten to be friends, and we keep writing letters, and it's really very nice.
I can imagine she's a good letter writer.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. Very, very thoughtful.
Yeah. So, yeah, the other thing before launching into talking about the letters that I want to mention is that one of the things I was doing in 1965 was reading bits of The Lord of the Rings to Mrs. Cutler, because I was obsessed with it, and nobody else knew about it then. There was one other family in Fairbanks that kept checking the books out of the library. I never knew who they were. you know, but I'd go in and hope to find them there, the books, I mean, and they'd be gone, and, you know, it was just... I was one of those kids that was just taken over by the whole mythos of it, and I didn't meet other people who had read it that I hadn't told about it until I was in college. But, you know, I've read some of them, read some of the chapters to Mrs. Cutler, and then I sent her the books when I got back to Detroit, they'd come out in paperback, and then everybody knew about it. And so that was interesting, you know, just as a point of profound contact with her.
And how? So, and you were in Fairbanks for 3 years.
Yeah, 62 to 65, and I was between ages 10 and 13.
Yeah, sounds like it had an enormous impact in your life. I'm impressed with how many kind of specific details you remember.
Oh yeah, it did, and I think it was actually the combination of reading Tolkien and being in Fairbanks at the same time. You know, because I had been a pretty conventional city kid before then. And, you know, here's this landscape, and it does things. You know, you have to be really careful about going out in the cold and how you're dressed for it and so on. And the sun does interesting things. And I don't know that I saw the aurora the first year because we were living in Fairview Manor, which isn't there anymore, but it's down sort of where Raven Landing is now, you know, on Airport Way, which has more street lights and brighter ones than it did then, but, you know, it just wasn't a great sky-viewing location. But we moved to Belaine Lake the next year, and that was before it had any lights, and I would go out there and skate, you know, shovel off a little area of lake and skate on it, and the aurora would be out as often as not. And, you know, so there's the landscape, and then there's this very northern-influenced, you know, invented mythology, invented world that has that kind of severity to it as well. And, you know, I was just never the same after that. You know, going back to the city, that was interesting too. It was the height of Motown Records and, you know, racial strife in 1968 and all the things that were going on. But, you know, I always had this other point of reference. And I always intended to move back to Alaska, and, you know, I keep thinking, well, I should have gone there to college, but it wasn't a great school. I was going to go to school and figure out something to do that I could, you know, make a living at up there, and, you know, kind of didn't. And it wasn't a great time to get an education. You know, everything was so loose, and I wasn't smoking a lot of dope, but I knew a lot of people who were, including some of the faculty, and you know, it was way too laid back for somebody who wanted to be purposeful. And then I fell in love with somebody who didn't want to live that far from her family, and then I didn't go back for a long time because it was too painful. You know, I didn't want to go back as a tourist. But I'm going to be retiring later this year, and you know, I can at least spend longer stretches of time than a vacation there. So, you know, it's all come back in full force how much I'd really like to be there.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
But the letters, and this kind of connects with the letters too, because one of the early ones, and I was just so grateful to get letters from Mrs. Cutler because she did understand so much, you know, about me and about anybody. And so I could write to her about how much I missed being there. And, you know, she wrote back and said, actually, I marked it here. I donated the originals of the letters to the UAF archive in October, but I have copies. And she rats.
See,
dead
Catherine,
airspace.
Talking, I think I might try and mute my end just because I'm in the office area here.
Okay.
In the kind of lobby, and there's a bunch of people starting to come in. So I'm just going to experiment with this and try muting. And so I'm listening.
Okay.
I just don't want to have any of the audio record on top of what you're saying.
Right, okay.
So take your time.
Yeah. Okay, it's got to be this one, and Yeah. Can I read you a couple of paragraphs?
Yes, please. That would be wonderful.
Okay. And she never could remember whether I spelled my name with a C or a K, so this time it's with a K. Kathy, I was very moved by your letter received just before Christmas. It made our surroundings take on your love for them and made ordinary comings and goings in the environment seem privileged passages through a beautiful land. I think your sunrise at 10 near the Eielson building hit hardest. It had been very cold, and I had been helping Greta Brown start her car on a morning after we had pushed it the night before and left it on a plug-in in the parking lot to warm up overnight, and the sun suddenly defined an edge of mountain as it beamed through the spun air, and instead of coming up, it moved across, tracing a glowing edge of peak and hollow, gleaming out of the soft white air breathlessly, timelessly. She used mostly dashes for punctuation, so breathlessly, dash, timelessly, dash. You see, qualities are there, wherever we are, yet how we take them is the big question, and late sunrises can seem not a privilege but a denial of earlier sunrises in winter, and only because one is used to having them earlier. But, oh, Kathy, you are right. I would worry, I will worry, if you withhold your love from the land in which you find yourself now, you who find treasure, humanity, meaning where others only might find places in which to realize the accepted ambitions of life. You will surely not withhold your perception. I am pretty old and already tempted to see wealth as in the past, but I resist and resist this because I know there is always a kind of magic between people and things. And if the magic dies, I know that it is I who am dying, not the things depriving me. There, I know I'm preaching, but that's because you understand and I can say what seems really important, for I know you can speak in like manner. And, you know, I'm 13 years old and she's writing me in this way. And
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah.
And I actually, it was so, would you be willing to read it again? And maybe just a little more slowly, just because it's so much to take in, and it would be so fabulous to have a recording of you reading those paragraphs.
Okay. And you can edit the other one out?
Sure, yes.
Yeah, okay. Kathy, I was very moved by your letter received just before Christmas. It made our surroundings take on your love for them and made ordinary comings and goings in the environment seem privileged passages through a beautiful land. I think your sunrise at 10 near the Eielson building hit hardest. It had been very cold, and I had been helping Greta Brown start her car on a morning after we had pushed it the night before and left it on a plug-in in the parking lot to warm up overnight. And the sun suddenly defined an edge of mountain as it beamed through the spun air. And instead of coming up, it moved across, tracing a glowing edge of peak and hollow, gleaming out of the soft white air breathlessly, timelessly. You see, qualities are there, wherever we are, yet how we take them is the big question, and late sunrises can seem not a privilege but a denial of earlier sunrises in winter, and only because one is used to having them earlier. But, oh, Kathy, you were right. I would worry, I will worry, if you withhold your love from the land in which you find yourself now. You who find treasure, humanity, meaning, where others only might find places in which to realize the accepted ambitions of life. You will surely not withhold your perception. I am pretty old and already tempted to see wealth as in the past, but I resist and resist this because I know there is always a kind of magic between people and things, and if the magic dies, I know that it is I who am dying, not the things depriving me. There, I know I'm preaching, but that's because you understand, and I can say what seems really important, for I know you can speak in like manner.
Oh, it's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll and have to go down to the archives and read
letters. Yeah, yeah. And one of the things I was doing in the archive was trying to see whether there were other collections of her letters, because I can't imagine that I was the only person she would write to in this way, and I would love to see what she said to other people. But there was actually pretty much nothing, you know, just a couple of little social letters. I don't remember, the man whose portrait you have there, there were some papers of his, and I looked through them, and you know, there were just a couple of quick notes, but nothing like this. And, you know, it was just amazing to have another adult who took me as seriously as my parents, sometimes more seriously than my parents were willing to take me. And, you know, just to talk to me as somebody, you know, I was already writing plays by that time and writing other stuff. And, you know, she saw me as somebody who knew how to work. And, you know, that was something we had in common. And
it really seems like she found a kindred spirit.
Yeah, yeah, for some reason. And, I mean, temperamentally, we weren't very much alike. But, you know, there was just this sort of glow of feeling between us. And, of course, as I got older and got toward the end of high school and the beginning of college, I started, you know, trying to get her to tell me what to do with my life, you know, how to use what I had. And she really felt like I was worrying about it too much at the beginning. You know, of course the time of preparation is important, but then you do things all the rest of your life too. You know, she was trying to tell me I didn't have to decide it just then. And I wasn't really able to take that in, but I see now what she meant. And, you know, I mean, I'm about 22 or so years older than she was when I first knew her. And, you know, so I see what she was getting at. But the other piece of a letter that I want to read is on that subject, because, you know, again, I was kind of trying to throw myself at something that would be difficult enough to sink my teeth into as work. I mean, it's ironic because really I've just gone on and had a lot of jobs involving books that don't add up to a career, really. You know, always written, you know, my songs and my books around the edges of that, but never stopped thinking about that. You know, but back then, and there's no year on this letter, so it's either 1970 or 71, so I'm 18 or 19, and anyway, I'm going to plunge in the middle of this letter. She says, I seem to want to, and the layout on the page was always interesting too. You know, sometimes she'd just put a word in the middle of the page, or she'd have a little sketch or something, you know, to illustrate what she meant, or she'd do a lot of underlining. You know, it was again, very free-spirited. Anyway, she says, I seem to want to say, good, you want to demand. Maybe we could call it a demanding or even demanding discipline for your writing. Good, capital letters, but much that comes easy to you will be right. The whole body of what others, society in general, thinks right and difficult, underlined 4 or 5 times, will be wrong. Most of the hard disciplines of society in general are rationalizations for willfulness. And then there will be some simple discipline for you to do which will insist, but you may dismiss over and over as impossible and not mattering that much. It will be like the glass hill in the fairy tale. Do you know that one? Set out immediately, knowing it is possible in a way you cannot fathom, but which will open before you as you go. With love and preachiness, Enid. And I didn't think about that for a long time, but I started taking some really first-rate voice lessons last May. And I went in, and this is an amazing teacher, the professional vocalists around Pioneer Valley, Massachusetts. Many of them go to her. And, you know, she's this amazing mezzo-soprano. And it took me years to think, you know, that I was worthy to study with her. And, you know, I said that to her the second or third lesson. And she said, oh, for the love of God. But I walked in for the first lesson and she said, the principle that I teach is that singing should be easy. You know, you shouldn't be struggling to get the sound out, and you shouldn't be struggling with, you know, stuff that's in your throat or in your mouth or anything. You know, here's where it comes from, and, you know, it's the diaphragm. And I've heard all this stuff before, but, you know, she's got all of these very simple tricks. You know, she's got about 15 of them, and you have to add them all up at once, but you do that over time, and then it really does become easy. And, you know, she's explaining all this to me in the first lesson, and I paid her and walked out and went and sat down to start the car and thought, wait a minute, that's that passage in that letter from Mrs. Cutler. You know, the thing that comes easily and insists and you dismiss it over and over is not mattering, but, you know, it keeps coming back and there it is. And, you know, that's going to be one of these things that comes easily and is a right thing. And it was just an extraordinary moment.
So these letters are in the archives.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm reading from copies.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, I may chat with, I'm doing some other projects with the Oral History Archives, and I may follow up with you with their, if you'd be willing, with their release form. I'd love to have a copy
of your story
go into the Oral History Archives.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got a lot to say about my time in Alaska on other subjects, too, that, you know, if they're interested, I'd be happy to talk with them, too.
Great. Yeah, no, it's and it sounds like such, you're here at such an interesting time.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, all these people that buildings are named after now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lee Salisbury was a colleague of my dad's, and, you know, we saw each other, our families saw each other a lot, and, you know.
And remind me,
No, go ahead.
Remind me what your father was doing on campus. I think you mentioned, was he teaching?
Yeah, he was in the English department. Yeah, he and Lee developed together, and there might have been other people involved in it too, this program called COPAN, College Orientation Program for Alaska Natives. And I donated some of my dad's teaching notes from that too. I sent another box to the archive a couple of months ago.
That must be, there's now something called the
Madsen Family Papers
program. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
I'm sure that the orientation program must have changed greatly, but it was the first attempt to do something like that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And you know, we knew Celia Hunter, and we knew all sorts of people.
Wonderful. Well, yes, I think let me chat with the Oral History Archives, and maybe either myself or somebody from them can follow up with you.
Okay, yeah, that sounds wonderful.
It'd be nice to get some of these stories, and you're so articulate, and it's such a pleasure to hear you talk about the things you're reading from the letter about Enid. You know, Enid observing the sun
mm-hmm.
on the mountains.
Yeah,
so moving.
Yeah,
the lights
yeah.
coming back right now.
Yes.
Yeah. It's very, very palpable.
I check a number of websites every day. The Newsminer is one of them, and the webcam from the Climate Center is another. And, you know, so I see the sun coming higher up.
Yeah, it's an exciting time of year. It really feels like it's roaring into spring, even though it's, you know, 16 below in the morning when you get up.
Well, that's actually good. It means the ice park hasn't melted yet.
That's right.
Yeah, Sue Dean I just got a letter from her on Saturday, and she said Steve had carved part of the Mad Hatter's Tea Party at the ice park. So
wonderful. I haven't been to see it yet, but I'll have to make sure I go before it gets too.
Well, he did the caterpillar, and I think he did another one.
Oh, fun!
Yeah,
sounds great. Well, Catherine, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again, and I'm so glad I got to meet with you in October. And I just want to apologize again for the difficulty communicating, and
Don't worry about that.
Hectic things have been on my end, but we'll be. It's wonderful to have spoken to you. We'll be. I'll be sharing the images of the paintings with Acquisitions Committee on Thursday, and I think everybody will be really excited.
So okay, that's
up
good.
With you, after that, and maybe you can follow up with me regarding the recording. And I'm so glad that you were able to get a higher quality recording.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to use this studio. And thanks so much for the opportunity. It's nice to tell these stories to somebody who knows the place.
Yeah, such a pleasure for me. So, well, thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to try and solve my phone issue this afternoon, see what's going on. And I don't know what's going on with the email going into spam. So all
No, that's okay. I think that's at my end, and I told it, to always trust your address.
Okay.
So, okay.
Yeah, well, it's sort of comedy of errors getting started this morning, but thanks, and we'll look forward to talking with you later in the week or early next week.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Email when I put the thing in here.